We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
The New Orleans Pelicans select Zion Williamson.
And Holiday, the dribble penetration. So tough going to the goal.
Zion! High up on the rim to rip it down!
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Dua and Mason Ginsburg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time.
Welcome to In the Know. We are in the middle of a pretty disappointing Pelicans losing. It's not a streak, I guess, technically, because they won against the Kings. But
Kings aren't an NBA team. It's a losing streak.
It's a losing streak, right? But the Pelicans are on this road trip where they have lost every game but the Kings. And there was one postponement against Dallas, which is technically not a loss. And I will take that. But, you know, the Pelicans aren't in great shape. Twitter is doing its thing when the Pelicans starts losing. So we are here to talk you through all of that and more. So, Mason, have you thrown out the season yet?
Yeah, it's lost, right? It's like we should have like a degree or like a tracker with like how a scale of like green to red, how lost is the season every week. I think that would be a really good addition. But it's, I mean, there's been drastic overreactions. I don't think this team is playing well. Let's get that out of the way. But also what I've been harping on is like this road trip sucks. They're doing longer road trips because of the pandemic, which I think is totally reasonable to limit the travel as much as possible, or limit the number of miles travel, I guess, or number of times you got to get on planes. But they've also played not just good teams. I mean, the Clippers, Lakers, and Jazz based on how poorly Denver started, they could be the top three teams in the West when all said and done. And so not only that, but those three teams are uniquely positioned to beat the type of team the Pelicans have in terms of, or how they want to play.
A bad
in
team.
Terms of,
yeah. Uniquely positioned to beat a bad team.
fair enough. But you look at these teams,
good
with
teams.
With these teams with good rim protectors like AD and with Gobert, and the Pelicans obviously don't shoot threes and they want to get their points in the paint. Zion does not care for that though, and Zion will score because Zion's a monster. But other than that, that's kind of how they want to get their points, unless you're Lonzo. And then on the other, and then on the other side of the ball, I mean, they face teams that shoot a lot of threes and shoot well from three. And so it's been a perfect storm of crap for this road trip. And the schedule eases up starting tonight against Minnesota. A lot of home games, a lot of winnable games. How many they do win is subject to anyone's belief, because I mean, they lost to the Hornets, so who knows? But you know,
the Hornets are good. They have LaMelo.
I mean, I'm a big LaMelo guy. I'm pretty sure he's gonna be my keeper on my fantasy basketball team. So I am all in on the give me all the LaMelo ball stock. But yeah, I mean, I think things are about to take a turn, and whether that's because the Pelicans improve or it's because the schedule gets easier, we know that it doesn't matter which one's true and which one's false. That's how fans will react. So, you know, and it's understandable, but yeah, it's been a rough few games.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, if you're one of those people that where the world is falling down, go ahead, you know, enjoy the game however you want to enjoy it. If that brings you joy, good for you. You know, I think previously on this pod, we used to try to walk people off the ledge, and frankly, like, I feel like it's a waste of energy at this point. And you know, we're not anybody that's going to be telling people how they should be watching the game. So enjoy how you want to enjoy. As far as how I feel where the Pelicans are, they're 5-9 after perhaps the toughest portion of their schedule. Once again, due to national TV scheduling, the Pelicans have a difficult strength of schedule early on. I think from here on out till this half of the season ends, it's about the ninth easiest. It's going to be significantly easier. They're not going to be playing as many great teams as you mentioned. You know, one of the reasons the Grizzlies do so well is because Ja Morant is just, no one wants to watch him. They don't get put on national TV games, and they get an easy schedule. I'm sorry. I had to get that shot in after all the trash that has been coming our way.
I was waiting to react until you reacted yourself to it.
Yeah. No, but seriously, as far as the strength of schedule goes, the Pelicans have had a difficult one, and I believe things should be improving unless the Pelicans face their usual litany of injuries, in which case I am also not going to be too disappointed, because it's one of the greatest drafts in a while. I'm very excited for this upcoming draft. So it'll take a lot to tear me down. And, you know, I think a Zion Williamson injury would tear me down for sure. A Brandon Ingram injury would tear me down for sure. So I'm hoping with all my heart that doesn't happen. But other than that, you know, this season's whatever. I think they're going to get better. I think they're going to get better defensively. One thing that's important, outside of their atrocious defense these past few games, is the Pelicans are actually doing a decent job of scoring the ball. Their offensive efficiency has been remarkably better than what it was in the beginning of the season. And partially, I think it's due to Zion just bulldozing anyone and everyone. Over the last seven games, he's averaging 27.5 points a game. He's shooting like 64% from the field. It's like a true shooting of like 67%. He has been a completely different player than he was in the beginning of the season. And anyone that's still carrying those beginning of the season narratives, oh, he doesn't look the same, he's not doing this, they're not paying attention. This is the best Zion has looked in a Pelicans uniform ever. He is absolutely destroying things. And, you know, there's guys like you said, like Rudy Gobert, just cannot do a single thing to stop him. Just can't. And that's extremely promising for the Pelicans going forward, especially if their outside shot starts falling, because the Pelicans have the tools to be a decent offensive team between Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson. I am a bit disappointed in Brandon Ingram. He has cooled off pretty significantly. And, you know, I think that's a topic I'd like to discuss maybe a little bit later in the pod, is Brandon Ingram and what his play means and all that. Mm-hmm. But you know, he's still the Pelicans. I think Zion has been the Pelicans' best player over the last stretch of games. But you know, I think Brandon Ingram's still Pelicans 1A 1B type person, and they need him to really bring it back to that level previously. And I think he will. As the schedule gets going earlier. So ultimately, you know, before the season started, you and I think both predicted this team being out of the playoffs in that play-in range. Ninth or 10th seed was around the prediction. I think maybe 10th was both of us, maybe 9th. I'm not entirely sure what exactly was. I'll have to go back and look at that. But they seem to be on pace to be doing just that. I'm not overly concerned. We'll see. We'll see. I still think, you know, if this is what rock bottom looks like for the team, it's way better than the rock bottom last year where they were 6 of 22 to start the season. Yeah. Either 5 of 9, and it's a huge difference in 6 and 22.
I did not. So some of y'all may remember, so Graham McQueen used to do some stuff with us on River Street Shots, and he tweeted a stat out that I was convinced was just fake. And then he said it wasn't, and I haven't checked it, but it's one of the most Pelican stats you'll ever possibly find. Apparently they've been 5 and 8 for each of the past 10 seasons, including this one. Like, that feels fake. It does. Like, but yet again, it's so uniquely Pelicans to be 5 and 8 for each of the past 10 years. Like, to get to that record, just, it says so much about what's happened with this team.
I feel like it feels wrong.
Right?
I feel like under Gentry, we've started like 0-4 and 0-8, and maybe it's possible, like, after like the 0-4 and 0, you know, starts, they've won enough games to get to like 5 and 8. I don't know.
So feel free, one of our listeners, to stat check that. I did not, but that was just like, that would be incredible. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you on the fact that I think it's easy to say that Zion's been the Pelicans' best player over the last few games, and others will quickly point to his defense being a massive negative. And my response would be, sure, but it's not like anyone else on the Pelicans is doing that much better on the defensive end. And like I said, it's a part of the teams they played are obviously, you know, very good. And so that's been a challenge. But I mean, what Zion's been able to do with the efficiency that he's done it in, and just, I think that's going to start paying more dividends for his teammates. And I think, I hope I feel like Stan's already done better things to get Zion the ball on the move. And I think as he continues to like assert himself, that creates more opportunities for others, because, you know, no matter where you put Zion on the floor, I don't give a shit how good or bad he's shooting the ball from outside the paint. He's going to draw attention. And sooner than later, teams are going to start watching out for Zion, not just at the rim, not just within 5 or 10 feet from the rim, but they're going to be all eyes on him wherever he's on the floor. And that, you know, he doesn't need a jumper to attract the, opposing defenders and create more space for guys like BI.
I feel like I'm living in some weird world, because if a young player is scoring 27.5 points a game, shooting about 65% from the floor, that should be headlines all over the place. You know, he's missing like 3 shots a game. It's totally absurd what he's doing. You know, ESPN, every time he, you know, every game he plays, they'll put out a stat like he's the first person to do this since Shaq. You know, he is leading the NBA right now in scoring at the rim. How absurd is that? And then to me, that needs to be the headline everywhere. And people get so lost in nitpicking everything else, which, hey, it is a fair criticism. His defense sucks. It stinks. Woohoo. Great. This dude is doing historic things. We've seen bad defenders before. He's not a historically poor defender.
Anthony Bennett is that guy.
Oh, my God. I mean, there are worse defenders in the league than Zion Williamson right now. And if Zion is still this level of atrocious on defense 3 to 4 years from now, yeah, it's worrisome. And it's going to play into how the team should build around him. But I ain't worried about that right now. And, you know, if you're like Mac and you are worried about it right now, well, have fun, man. And enjoy your life how you want to enjoy it. To me, I want to see the big man dunk.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I feel like, I don't know. I feel like it's very interesting what players we decide to give leeway to and what players we don't. And I guess it context matters, right? It's, you know, what do you expect from this player at his peak? And so there are other players who are doing magical things on one side of the ball, and we're not yet nitpicking the other side because, you know, Zion's got time. he's in a sophomore season. Rookies are almost always bad on defense. And so look, and sometimes if you want to call it, I think the effort is one thing that I think is fair. On the one hand, he's doing so much offensively. He's probably, you know, he's definitely expending more of his energy on the offensive end and taking some breaks on defense, which a lot of players do, spoiler. But I feel like, you know, the attention to detail and I think the effort will come. I don't think you're ever going to see him be as on the move defensively as he is on the offensive side. I'm not, that's fine. but yeah, I mean, let's just,
no one wants to talk about Luka's defense the first 2 years in the league. No one wants to talk about Jokic's defense,
right?
You know, like Damian Lillard for the longest time was one of the worst defenders in the league. Kyrie Irving was one of the worst defenders in the league. You know, I get it, but I feel like we're taking crazy pills where this dude is just a historic scoring machine. I feel like, you know, that's the true sign of greatness, where when you're making the completely absurd look normal to where people become numb to it. You know, that's the true sign of greatness to me. And that's what Zion is doing, to where people have become numb to his output, to where they're nitpicking anything and everything else.
Yeah. And everyone, the hot topic, obviously, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit more, is the spacing concept. And it's almost like it doesn't make sense if you talk about the two things together and then talk about them the way that you do. And it's on the one hand, it's the Pelicans don't have spacing for Zion. And on the other hand, it's Zion still putting up 30 points a game on incredible efficiency. It's like, okay, so which is it? You know, you can't tear down Zion when you're talking about how crowded it is in the paint, because there's no spacing. And then it doesn't make any sense to me. No one wants to give the man his due for what he's doing. I don't know. I hope that there's a course correction coming, but you know, who knows? But as we saw with Shaq and Donovan Mitchell after the Pelicans Jazz game on TNT, we just like to tear down good players, apparently. So the league needs to do a better job of that overall.
So I guess this is a good time to lead the conversation into, you brought up spacing. So let's bring it into roster construction. Let's talk about David Griffin for a second. There seems to be a lot of heat from, I'm just going to say it, the most of the heat's coming from the Lakers crowd and the Lakers affiliated crowd and the certain people who love to pander to that crowd. You know who you are, but there's a lot of heat coming from that crowd about how David Griffin completely fumbled on roster construction for this Pelicans. And, you know, he's doing the team a huge disservice, and Brandon Ingram and Zion can't thrive in this environment, and all the above. Do you feel like that's a fair allegation?
No. I think the concern is fair. The expectation is not. I mean, look at the team that was on the floor last year, and then look at the team that is on the floor this year. And like, what was possible to change in that span, which is, you know, after the Jrue Holiday trade, there's really, I just don't think it's fair to just expect a magic wand to be brushed over this team on one off season. And on top of that, to make moves for this season, potentially at the expense of future seasons. Like I am sure there's somebody that the Pelicans could have acquired for this year that helps the spacing problem more than, you know, is happening right now. I also know that Griff is not thinking about this season in a vacuum. He's thinking about the long term and things he can do to position this Pelicans team for success. And so that's one piece. The other piece is, I don't think Griff or many of us saw the regression across the board from a lot of Pelicans players. Like I think Lonzo's the easiest one to point to, but also he was Now, he had a hot 2 months of shooting, and so I don't think it was really – it was maybe we – I think we collectively maybe overestimated the likelihood that he was going to be at least like – I didn't think he was going to repeat last year's three-point percentage, but I thought he would get close enough to at least be a threat. He has not been. Josh Hart can't shoot a corner three to save his life, even though he's gotten open three after open three. You've got Bledsoe somehow has been one of the better three-point shooters on the team, which pretty much says all you need to know. Obviously, the struggles of J.J. Redick have been – very hurtful. I mean, I would say that his shooting, if he was shot the way that he has throughout his career, the Pelicans probably have at least one more win, maybe two. And so, I mean, there's just a combination of factors here that don't absolve David Griffin from any blame. Maybe he was a little bit too optimistic on some of the guys he had, but at the same time, this is a long-term view here. I don't think anyone within the Pelicans front office gives a shit if you really gave them truth serum about whether or not this team makes the playoffs this season. So I think, you know, that's kind of where I stand. I'm sure you have other topics to add to that.
Yeah. I mean, to me, if you want to criticize Griffin, first, you got to figure out what standard you're holding him to. What is the measuring stick here? If your own measuring stick is the Pelicans need to be a good team this season, they should have been a playoff team, a second round team, whatever, a successful team this season, and that's the measure you're holding Griffin to, yeah, he has absolutely failed that. Is that the measuring stick the Pelicans are holding themselves up to? Is that the measuring stick the coaching staff is holding themselves up to? I would doubt it. In fact, Stan Van Gundy explicitly said in his introductory presser, they do not look at the season in terms of wins and losses. They do not look at the season in a results-oriented way. They don't do that. And I know a lot of people are going to be like, well, if you're not in it to win it, why are you even in the business? If you're not trying to win, what are you doing? And I get where that mentality comes from, but there is a much bigger picture in play here. And some people just don't have the patience for it. Other people who knew this team would be eighth or ninth seed are suddenly having issues with a team that is projected to be eighth or ninth. I mean, not even eighth, ninth and 10th seed are suddenly having issues with a team that's on pace to go that far. I feel like there's a lot of cognitive dissonance here. Would I have done differently? Would I have done things differently if I was David Griffin? Yeah, I think there are a few things, a few moves I would have made that would have been completely different. Like, for example, I probably would not have extended Adams. I think he's been really good. I don't think there was a reason to extend him. In fact, I probably would not have made the Adams trade, period. Because in my personal philosophy, investing assets into non-star bigs, basically, or bigs that don't have card-like skills, is not the greatest way to build a roster. That's just my opinion. Am I wrong about how Zion and Adams work? Yeah, I thought that they wouldn't work that well. They have blown away my expectations when it comes to the success of this team rebounding and the success of Zion individually. I thought it'd be a lot worse. I thought it would look like the Favors situation. Adams is much better than Favors. I give him credit for that. I would have made that move completely different. But to say that, you know, this team isn't living up to the expectations, well, I think some expectations need to be reevaluated. You already went down the roster in terms of, you know, yes, Lonzo's not performing. Hart's having a down year. JJ's having a down year. Melly has been totally invisible.
I fault Griff for that. I think expecting him to help this team, given I think we maybe gave him a little bit too much. We overinflated his value last season, despite the numbers staring us in the face that I didn't.
Who's we?
Sorry, fair enough. Me. I built up this idea in my head that Melly could still be a stretch four, even though the numbers last season showed that that was not what he did because it was only one season of data. But, you know, that's on Griff. I mean, if he thought that Melly was going to be a guy who could help, because he has not. So I will happily fault him for that.
Well, yes and no, right? So, like, I fault him for making the Adams move that put you in a position where you couldn't meaningfully upgrade from Melly, right? Because the Pelicans right now are brushed up against the luxury tax, and they weren't able to be a factor at all in free agency. So like that's a mistake. Do I think it's a costly mistake in the long run? Like, you know, if the Pelicans were able to replace Melly with another minimum level 3-4, maybe they win one or two games more over the whole season than they win now. Does that change who David Griffin and the Pelicans want to be 3 years from now? No. And so with Adams, even though he would not have been a player acquisition of my choice, they went after who they thought would be a core piece. I feel like he's played well enough to where you could say he's a core piece.
Yep.
With Zion and Ingram and Adams and some of the young players. But, you know, it's like your three best players have been those three by far. And it's not even been close. And I feel like, okay, well, if you have those three building blocks locked in over the next 2 years, you can really focus on either internal development on the perimeter or just loading up on the perimeter and adding to that core. Because in a vacuum, you know, if you had guards that were remotely competent instead of what the Pelicans have right now in that starting backcourt, no one in the world would be talking about Adams' spacing issues. Because it's not like he's playing 36 minutes a game. The Pelicans are still going moments where they're playing Zion at the five, or, you know, trying to put Melly next to him. They're still experimenting those areas. And I do believe the Pelicans plan on getting front court players that can play with both Adams and Zion and give them the flexibility to play small. I think that's the plan here. So, you know, Griffin them went after a guy who they thought they might be a core piece. He's played like a core piece. That's fine. Whatever.
I think we talked about this before, but I view Adams as a means to an end, right? I think he is a guy, and I agree with everyone who said if you're going to pay him that much money to just be a culture setter and an off the court help, that's insane. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not all. Like, I think it's critical for the Pelicans, but I agree. Like, you don't trade for and extend that guy the kind of money you did for someone who's just a culture setter. Like, Griff clearly viewed Adams as a piece who could be a strong fit with Zion in a lot of ways. Is it the spacer like everyone covets? No, but as we said ad nauseum on this podcast, there are very few fives in the league that actually provide spacing. There are some that are competent from 3-point range, and that's nice, but very few provide spacing enough where defenses care to leave the paint to go defend them. And that's just, I feel like we can't stress that point enough on this podcast.
Because, well, I want to add another layer to that, where defenses care to leave Zion. Specifically.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Specifically. Yeah. I think it's different to leave the paint. You know, they might leave the paint if it's a lesser player than Zion. With Zion, four or five eyes on the court, or pairs of eyes, will always be on him.
You know, and look what he's doing still. It's crazy.
And look what he's doing still. To me, when you talk about, oh, does this fit with Zion? Spacing is just one thing. Shooting is just one component of the fit. You need to worry about the rebounding fit. You need to worry about the defense fit. You need to worry about everything else. And I think it was Adams himself who mentioned it. He's like, okay, well, it's not just about me and Zion. It's about the other three other guys that are out there as well. You know, you got to work with everyone else. And if you have competent guard play, if you have high level guard play, the basketball fit is so much cleaner than one spacing issue. But I get it. I mean, and I don't want to underrate spacing. I truly think when the Pelicans team is going to be at its best, like if they're ever going to be competing, they're going to have a lineup, and it may not be a starting lineup, but they're going to have a kill lineup, and that kill lineup is going to involve a player that can shoot and defend that they can put next to Zion. And he may be a center, he may be a combo forward, whatever. I don't know what that looks like. But it will be basically a four out, one in situation with Zion being the one in. I believe that.
Yeah. And I just want to add a little bit more to the spacing topic, because so that's the first point is around the five, the center position, and how that really works as far as how much space you can really give in the paint. The other piece of this is the, you know, is what, even on the perimeter, what justifies as a floor spacer, right? And I feel like it's also like, I pointed to Etuan Moore as this guy who, like, yeah, he shoots great from three, but he's not, he doesn't have a quick trigger, and he's not someone who's just going to launch and launch and launch. And so teams aren't as quick to go out and worry about him than other players. Like, I feel like you need both competency and quantity. You need both those things to be truly floor spacer. Like, I was looking at the some of the data on cleaning the glass, and they give percentiles based on what position you play on how, you know, your frequency and your accuracy. And so because the last two games were against Utah Jazz have seven players that are 50th percentile or better in, six, who in frequency for 3-point shooting and accuracy this season. The Pelicans have one, and it's Bledsoe. It's not even BI. It's not even Redick. BI doesn't have the frequency, which I thought was actually very telling. We probably should talk a little more about that. BI is 20th percentile in 3-point frequency this season for his position, which is a forward. And his accuracy is above 50th percentile, but Bledsoe's the only guy above for both. And that's just, that's because you do need both of those things to space the floor. And that kind of comes back to the off season and what of those guys were available, and also guys that you feel like you aren't going to hemorrhage points on the other side of the floor. So there's a lot more that you need than 3-point percentage to create true spacing. And I feel like that's also unfairly held against Griff, as if there's tons of guys available to provide that level of floor spacing for someone like BI or Zion.
Well, and that goes to another point. It's like, it's important to have guys with those percentages, but those guys are functionally useless if you can't get them the ball or create shots for them, right? And so that's why this concept of creators and shot creators, and brings me back to the guard play that I've been yelling about for basically years, right? Is the ability to put players on the floor who make defenses commit, make defenses guess, make defenses rotate, and leave those percentage guys open, and are also able to deliver them the ball. There's two components. It's one, to make the defense move, and two, deliver them the ball, right? The Pelicans suck at both of them. They do. The only guy that really warps defenses right now is Zion. And I mean, JJ's doing it, but JJ's, you know, 300 years old, and
damn,
at this point, he's been easy to focus on because he's the singular threat there, and teams know what to expect, and they know what kind of plays that the Pelicans are running. And even then, you know, he's doing a good job of busting his ass. So, you know, credit to JJ, but
taking charges, like,
right. You know, the Pelicans have one guy that's really drawing that level of attention, but the component of getting them the ball has eluded them, right? Ingram, when he's in the mood to do it, is pretty darn good at it. But he's got to be in the mood to do it. And I guess this is a good time to talk about Ingram, who I've personally been disappointed in this season. He's coming on a maximum contract. He started the season really hot. His playmaking was at a really high level at the beginning of the season. It has completely fallen off. You know, he's not assisting his teammates anymore. His scoring output is less of an issue to me as opposed to how he's playing. I don't care how many points he scores and how efficiently he scores them. That's less of an issue. I think he's going to be a good scorer. What's problematic to me is he's starting to do those things where he meets adversity and then he shrinks. And if he sees a double, if he sees, okay, well, I can't get to my spot, I can't score, I'm not going to force it, he just gets rid of the ball and hides in the background, doesn't even look to get others involved. And to me, if you're working in sub-ideal conditions, if you're playing with the backcourt of Lonzo Ball and Eric Bledsoe and you got to do all the heavy lifting, well, do the heavy lifting. Get others involved. Create openings for your teammates. Get them going. And then, you know, maybe you'll be able to find your own groove. To me, all of his best games, or not all of them, but a lot of his best games have come when he's decided to be a playmaker, a shot creating entity, rather than a guy who's going to, I hate to say it, but he's been hijacking the offense frequently. And initially it was designed for him to kind of do so because the guards suck, but he was playmaking while he was hijacking the offense. At this point, it just seems like he's out to do it for himself. And I don't know what it is. And it's just a bad stretch of games. I'm not saying this is who he is or it's who he's going to be, but I need more from him on that end than what he's currently doing.
Do you feel like I'm curious if you think that the start to the season that he had is causing us to unfairly rate the most recent stretch. Like, cause I feel like he came out of the gates this season with a whole new playmaking element that we had not seen before. And now he's kind of fallen off a cliff in that regard. So I'm just wondering if, like, you know, overall you feel like he's taken at least a step but the first few games are just impacting the level that we expected from him in the next few games.
No, I think it's a willingness. I think he's like willfully going into doubles and realizing he can't do anything and just kind of giving up the ball there rather than going into doubles with the idea of, okay, well, if I am getting doubled here, I'm going to look for the best opening. He's just kind of been like, oh, can't do anything here, whatever. And there's a mentality change. And look, if you're a max guy, you're going to get held to max standards. If you're a guy that gives an interview that says he wants to kill every opponent in front of him, he wants to be the greatest, those are your aspirations, well, you got to do a lot more. You know, and that's just on offense. The second part is he's been a disaster defensively. Everyone wants to talk about Zion's defense. We're entering year 5 of Brandon Ingram being one of the worst defenders at his position. Year 5. And something has to change there. He's got to get himself going on that end, especially if the offense isn't working.
Yeah. And it's because, I mean, you've got a point somewhere, right? The Pelicans up until this recent stretch, the Pelicans are an okay defensive team in aggregate, but they've struggled mightily over the last couple of weeks. I think that cleaning the glass at him is in the last 2 weeks, 29th in the NBA in defense. And so I know you've had Lonzo Ball miss a couple of games, and Lonzo has been one of the team's better defenders. Eric Bledsoe is, you know, not the most versatile defender, but he's a good defender. Steven Adams obviously is very solid. So, you know, these guys can all have lapses, obviously, but I mean, it hasn't been the same. I mean, as the Pelicans' two best offensive players, that just haven't carried, haven't pulled their weight on the defensive end. And that's not just, I mean, you know, they don't have to be great defenders, either of them, but they can't be as bad as we've seen.
Yeah, and so it just kind of highlights the issues for the Pelican are many. They have lots of issues, and they go all up and down the roster. Each player in the starting lineup, you could pick apart and find fatal flaws. And it just goes back to how you want to weight these things. For the long term, you know, for championship contention windows, the two biggest issues are indeed Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram's defensive abilities. If those are going to be your two best players, it's going to be damn hard to build a good defense around them if they're playing those two high leverage forward positions. It's going to be really hard. Right now, we're not in that long term. In the short term, it's got to be the guard play. For me, at least, this is my opinion, right? And everything I'm saying is my opinion, whatever. It's got to be the guard play. I think the guard play is going to open up much better opportunities for Zion. It's going to make Ingram have less of a load on his shoulders and allow him to do what he does best, right? If you have a guy that can get people into offense to really leverage the defense, to really leverage Ingram's ability to catch and shoot the three, who, you know, the past Jazz game, he came out the first quarter 4 for 4 from three, all of them catch and shoots. Never got those opportunities again, scored 16 points in the first quarter, scored 7 the rest of the game. Just completely disappeared. Stop going after the ball. Stop trying to get his teammates involved. He just was a total non-factor. Stan Van Gundy also said word for word, Brandon Ingram was a non-factor for the rest of the game. You know, and that's an issue. But that issue to me is more on the guards being unable to create opportunities for him than him. I'm giving him blame. I'm giving him responsibility because he talks big game and he should be better than that. But if there was literally anybody in the backcourt who could take that pressure off of him, you're going to have less moments where Ingram disappears.
Yeah, and I think this also gets back to, and maybe we come full circle and talk about, you know, the decisions made by Griff this offseason around those guard positions, and specifically Bledsoe. Because I think if there's another area you can point to and question, and it's something that we've seen from some fans, it's why Bledsoe? Because you could make the case that it wasn't Adams who put this team so close to the luxury tax. It was the fact that the Pelicans decided to go with Bledsoe over like George Hill, for example, in that trade. And I think there's two reasons for it, and you can pick apart both of them if you choose to. One is I think they wanted a tough-nosed defender and someone who they felt like maybe had a more diverse skill set and could be a secondary or a creator, because, you know, we don't know what before the season, we have no idea if BI is going to take that step as a shot creator and a playmaker for others. And so if you have George Hill, he doesn't get into the paint. He's kind of like Lonzo in that regard. And so who's going to attack? And so there is a basketball floor fit for Bledsoe that did not exist for George Hill, even though he's a much better 3-point shooter. The second was, I think you also have to look long-term and who do you think is going to have more value if you can flip him? And so, Bledsoe, who knows if the plan has ever been to keep him throughout the duration of his contract, or if you think he's going to get moved. Either way, it's a calculated
decision. I'll just say that it's not, it was never the plan for either player, whoever they kept, for them to keep them long-term. Yeah. And it still isn't.
Yeah. And so I think those are I still agree with those reasons being the one, and obviously that doesn't even talk about the defensive end, where Bledsoe is definitely a much better player than George Hill, though he's paid more. And the same point, the points you made with Adams, can you now use the MLE if you take George Hill instead of Bledsoe and grab someone else? Yeah. Like that's certainly possible. And that's if you prefer George Hill plus whoever you sign for the MLE is someone, maybe you can go get a guy who can create. I don't think that's the route the Pelicans would have taken, because you've already got so many guards with Nikhil and Kyra, if you want to get the minutes earlier on. But I think it was still the right choice with Bledsoe. But I do think that I hear fans when if they think that it wasn't. I mean, there's a case there. But I just think it's important again to think about both the short term and the long term, and it's not just about shooting. I think I think the core takeaway from this podcast is, basketball is a simple game, but it's also a very complicated game. There's a lot of skill sets you need to make a team good. And despite, the trend of the last few years, spacing, shooting is very important. But one, spacing's hard to create. It's not just about being able to make a three. And then two, there's a lot of other things that impact the ability to have a sustainable offense. And so it's a chess game. and so I hear fans if they think that was the wrong choice, but I don't think it was a bad choice.
Yeah, my reading of this season and going forward is, this is year two of a rebuild for them. Maybe even year 1.5, given the uncertainty with COVID. You didn't really have Zion the first year. And this is a brand new coach, right? So for back-to-back years, you've traded one top five player who is now a champion to, a top 20, top 25 player. Teams don't rebound quickly from trading that kind of talent, right? Whether or not the Pelicans are successful with those guys is a separate story. That doesn't mean, you're easily filling those vacuums. Those guys are really, really good. Two, it's the first year of Stan Van Gundy. It's a 4-year deal. It's a process. Year one is establishing a foundation, laying that foundation, creating a baseline, figuring out who's what, who's who, what can they do on both ends of the floor. And it's putting, Zion and Ingram in an uncomfortable position from an offensive standpoint, but it's also putting all of them in uncomfortable positions on a defensive standpoint because they suck. And so year one is working through that, and it's important data when it comes to roster construction. So, whatever they find out, if by the end of the year, Ingram adapts and he becomes this, high level creator option, it gives you a different idea of how to pursue a roster change going forward. If he turns into a good defender, it gives you a different idea of how to pursue roster construction going forward. Same thing with Zion. You're figuring out who your core pieces are. Turns out Lonzo's not a core piece. I mean, some of us may have said that for a long time, but you know, it's important to know, like, is that guy who was hot for 2 months, you know, can you find him again? Is he there? And he's probably there in stretches, but is he there consistently? No. You know, there's important data that they're gaining from this season, and it will help them in becoming a better team in the long run.
Yeah. And I want to bring that back to Adams too, because I know, and I hear you 100% loud and clear on the why extend him. I think Griff saw the market coming because of all the star players resigning and the players drying up, but the cap space not drying up. And so I understand the rationale. And I also think that last year of his contract, as you and I've discussed, it's trade fodder for sure as a way to match salary. But I also think, to your point, it's about, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to know that, putting a shooter alongside Zion is a good idea offensively. But let's test out some of the other stuff while we can. Let's figure out, you know, as a player with Steven Adams' skill set or something similar, what are the strengths and weaknesses of playing Zion with a guy like Steven Adams? And I'd rather figure that out while he's 20 and while Zion's still, you know, maturing and growing as a player than in his prime. I want to know every single answer by the time he comes into his prime. And so in that case, you know, again, well, why do you extend that guy if you don't know? Sure, I get it. But I think I'm very happy with everything else Steven Adams brings to this team on and off the floor. And I'm totally comfortable with that. And I think so far, like we've discussed, it's paying dividends so far. It's just about what are the right guards to put around him.
Yeah, my difference was just a philosophical one and how I feel about big men and their value. But, you know, philosophical differences aside, from a monetary standpoint, from what he brings to the team, I think it's fair market value, and it's not a crippling contract long term. It lasts you the duration of Zion and Jackson's rookie scale deals, lets you know who they're going to be by the end of it, allows you to go a vastly different direction if you want to before they're up for their second contract. So I get it. It's structured in a pretty team friendly way going forward. So whatever. I can't undo the acquisition. So, you know, I got to evaluate what's ahead and what's evaluating what's ahead. But that combination is fine to me. It's absolutely fine. What I see with the guards is not fine. And I guess we can shift this topic up a little bit into how you would approach the rest of the season. And we could talk about some trades if you want a little bit. But do you have any, like, concrete goals on how you would approach the season?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the three vet guards, and that by vet guards, I also include Lonzo, got to go. I mean, you've got to, I think, I'm not trying to just say, let's just tank and go for a draft pick. I'm saying, let's still try to win games. But I think you've got to free up some minutes. Just because of what we've seen from Na and even to a lesser extent, Kyra, who's been, you know, very limited minutes. So, but he's, I think we've seen a lot to like from him so far. And so you've got to create opportunities for them. And I think it, in a sense, you can get to some addition by subtraction in that regard, especially if you can move a guard for someone who can really fill that backup 3-4 position, since A, the Pelicans don't really have wing depth behind BI, and B, Melly's been just a disaster. And so that's definitely a clear area to upgrade, especially since the Pelicans don't really have any other young guys besides Jax, who's your backup 5. I don't know if we need to get into specifics. And I think I think you've got to move a guard at some point. And this, honestly, the sooner the better. I think you can still accomplish your goals of trying to compete for a playoff spot and that play-in game at very least while moving one of your vets.
Yeah, I agree. I'll take it a step further. Get rid of all three of them.
All three of them.
They're not going to be on this team in the future. They're just not. So if you have the opportunity to move them, take it. I get it. I get if there's no deals around, you don't want to be giving up assets to move these guys and all of that. So I get it. That's fine. But, you know, if I can get anything and even second round picks for JJ, take him. He's not going to be on this team. Take whatever you get, you know, Bledsoe, Take them. Don't care. Lonzo, everyone knows how I feel with that. So by doing so, I'm not, when you trade these players, it's not like you trade them and you get no player in return, right? Because the Pelicans already have one open roster spot. They're not going to trade all three of these and have four open roster spots a COVID year. It's not going to happen. They're going to get some players back. So it's not like you're trading them for nothing in terms of on-court equity. What you're going to get back matters. And I think the types of things that they should be going for are some veteran forwards and wings to complement the big man rotation, basically. That way you can, one, open up playtime for Nikhil, for Kyra. And I guess, you know, if having one more point guard type player on the roster wouldn't hurt. So, like, you know, if you're unable to move Bledsoe or Lonzo by the end of it, it's not the end of the world, just from depth purposes. But, you know, like, let's say you get back a Tad Young, let's say you get back a Lauri Markkanen, let's say you get back, you know, let's say you combine some salaries and go get Harrison Barnes. So those players are going to make you better, just in a different way. And so to me, you can still accomplish those goals of competing for meaningful games and being a good team while also getting a look at players who may be a part of your future core. No one's making any declarations that for sure these guys are going to be part of your future core, but it's important to find out early, especially when we get into situations where their contract is coming up, right? With Lonzo, you only had 2 years to evaluate him after that trade. And there wasn't that much time to keep it honest. I mean, he kind of showed who he was, but it's not that much time. With Nikhil, you don't want to get in a situation where that second contract is coming and he's barely played any meaningful minutes. Same thing with Kyra. You want to play the meaningful minutes. And if they are good for your team, excellent. If they are good for your team and another team values them more than you do, even better. You know, that's where you gotta go, in my opinion. And that doesn't mean tanking for L's, because I really think if you change the roster up a little bit, add some depth in that front court, and you know, you just had like one steady guard that was a veteran guard, you could be a better team and trade away the logjam you got going on in the backcourt. I think you can do that.
Yeah. And so I feel like if they trade all three, I'm not going to be upset about it. I guess I just didn't go that far from the outset, but like, I mean, for example, if they trade Lonzo and they trade JJ, I think there's still a team that makes sense where that Bledsoe works around. Not to say that you wouldn't just move him in the summer. But like, I'm okay with just good asset management. And if you feel like, for example, Bledsoe's value with one less year in his contract increases in the summer, and you think that, you know, you move on from JJ, who's expiring, you move on from Lonzo, because you don't, you know, for a lot of reasons, you get a guard, maybe you get one guard back, maybe you get zero guards back, and then you go with Bledsoe, Josh Hart, and Na and Kyra, and then you add, like you said, another 3-4 who can maybe play a little bit up at three, probably more at four. I think that gives you options. And so I think to your point, when I said you got to move one, I think I expect two out of the three out. I would be surprised if all three are moved by the deadline, but it wouldn't totally shock me.
Yeah, without spoiling too much of what I'm kind of writing in terms of trades, I'm working on this trade piece. It's the Bradley Beal piece. Okay, it's the Bradley Beal piece. I'm writing about it, but I'll just say this: that Bledsoe in this summer, he has, I think, $17-18 million deal the following year. And then the following year after that one, he only has $3 million guaranteed. So he's almost an expiring plus. And you need that kind of salary, that mid-range salary, that mid-size salary, if you ever want to go star chasing, if you ever want to just make meaningful trades for players, because good players make good money. You know, good players aren't cheap. They're not making less than $10 million usually, unless they're on the rookie scale contract. So you need that kind of salary. And so it's not the end of the world for me if they're unable to move him. There's no real suitors for him. And they kind of hold on to him, use him as that, you know, remember what we used Tyreek Evans as when we went after Boogie, kind of that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I think that makes sense, and I will. Maybe we should stop it there because I'm sure everyone's gonna be really excited to read it. No more so than you. Maybe you just read what you write and just like wish for Bradley Beal even more.
Yeah, I write it, I read it, and then I get really excited. Then I go watch his highlights, and I read my article again. And then I go watch his highlights, and I read my article again. And I go watch his highlights, and then you know, and then I'm on Twitter tweeting about it, and yeah, it's how I get through my days these days.
There are worse ways. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, no, I mean, be on the lookout for that, guys. It'll be interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think Mason and I agree, you know, on the fact that the Pelicans can find ways to be a competitive going forward. They're likely going to have an easier time given the strength of the opponents going forward. And if injury luck holds up, they shouldn't be this bad.
Yeah. I think that's a fair statement. And I think we could come back in a week or so, or even, you know, and the Pelicans next 10 games, I think Max sent a tweet out about it this morning. I mean, they're very winnable. I don't have the schedule in front of me, but they play Milwaukee, but besides that, I mean, they have a decent chance to win every single one of those other games. I think they've got a road game in Indiana. Hopefully they'll be wanting revenge after the shit show down the stretch they played against them in New Orleans. And so apart from that, lots couple games against the team we all love, the Rockets, and that has Eric Gordon and Boogie. So that should be fun. But yeah, I mean, check the schedule and you just feel like they can make a rebound here for no other reason than the teams aren't that good.
Yeah, still early, only 15 games played, long way in the season. Wait, there's been less than 15 games played for the Pelicans. They're 5-9. Yeah, 14 games played. Long way to go. Stay tuned for the Bradley Beal thing. Thanks for listening.
For the ones who know that a little late is always too late, and that the clock doesn't stop just because you're missing a part, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, and our KeepStock inventory management solutions help ensure you have the right stuff in the right place at exactly the right time. Visit Grainger.com/KeepStock to learn more. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.